It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Are you an early bird or a night owl? If you answered early bird, you're not alone. According to recent data, Americans are going to bed earlier and getting more sleep now than they did even just a year ago. And that shift is showing up in other trends, too. Dinner reservations, they're peaking around 5 p.m. instead of 7 p.m. And theaters and music venues are seeing an increased demand for matinee shows and earlier start times for movies, concerts, and live performances. Our next guest is reporting on this, why it is, and as she says, America has become a nation of early birds. She's here to help us understand the trend, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you find yourself calling it a night earlier than you used to? How's the early bedtime trend affecting you? Are you a night owl looking for more late night stuff to do? Are you an early bird loving the expanded matinee options? Join in at 800-642-1234. Oh, if you work in restaurants, theaters, late night things you might think of, are you seeing this trend where you work? 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@wpr.org. Rachel Wolf is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, where she covers consumer trends. Rachel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I've been following your reporting on this for a while, Rachel. It's super interesting. And last month you had a piece. There's some data now to support the idea that we're going to bed earlier. What are we finding?
That bedtimes are, in fact, moving earlier. So an analysis of more than 2 million Sleep Number customers found that those between 18 and 34 specifically went to bed at 10:06 on average in January, and that's compared to 10:18 the January before. So we're seeing bedtimes creep up.
And you reported on why this younger group is maybe going to bed earlier and sleeping more. And part of it is, I mean, it's what the doctors have been telling us for a long time now. Sleep is kind of good for us. Is that finally getting through to generations, I don't know, younger than mine?
That's definitely part of it. People are prioritizing sleep in a way that they didn't in the past. But young people also say that they're more exhausted than they've ever been. So there's definitely a positive component of prioritizing health, and then maybe a little bit of a negative one where people just feel really overwhelmed by financial matters in their own lives and then also things going on in the world.
And the first piece you wrote on this, or that I saw you wrote on this, I think it was back last summer, you were spotting this trend going on in the nightlife. And even in places that never sleep, supposedly like New York City and New Orleans, This is happening. What were some of the things you were hearing from people who work in these industries?
Yeah, I was hearing that on Broadway, you know, in the city that supposedly never sleeps, curtain times are earlier than they had been. So one Broadway buff I spoke to said that he actually missed a showing of Into the Woods because he thought that it was going to be at 8, like every other Friday night Broadway show he had ever been to. And then he went to grab the tickets, heard the Take Your Seats chimes, and his friends were still across town, so they ended up missing the show altogether. In New Orleans, which is also where I live, there are daytime dance parties and all other sorts of events that are happening before the sun even sets. So, you know, businesses are really seeing a craving for people who still want to have fun, but perhaps earlier than they did in the past.
That's funny. I was just in New Orleans a month ago or so, and yes, indeed, I could take in a 5 or 6 p.m. music show. And if I still kept going, I could see an 8. Like, that really worked for me. When you talk to club owners, are they seeing a preference for their clientele to take in that earlier show more so than that late night experience?
So I spoke to a bar in the East Village, New York, called Joy Face, and they have hosted what they call matinee dance parties. So they had one on Halloween. It was so successful, they ended up doing another one on New Year's, where the countdown to midnight was actually at 8 p.m. And to show just how in demand that event was, there was a wait list 200 people long to get in. So people really were looking for an 8 p.m. They wanted the countdown, but didn't want to wait all the way to midnight.
One other reason you noted in your reporting on this is remote work, hybrid work, things like that, maybe leading people to want to start their evening experience earlier and then being willing to be done with it earlier. How does that play into it?
Yeah, people who are working from home say that they are really ready to leave the house by the time they clock off at 5. Again, I can also attest to that personally. I am often looking for the company of more than my two cats by the time I close my computer. And so I'm heading to a happy hour, to the gym earlier than maybe I would have been when I was working in an office and had to commute first, and have found that there are a ton of people with the same idea. So one woman I spoke to in July said that it used to be waiting or getting to a restaurant at 5 p.m. on a Saturday night was a surefire way to get a reservation. Now it's better off waiting until 7 p.m. because there are no reservations at 5. Everybody's eating dinner then.
Rachel Wolf is with us from the Wall Street Journal. She covers consumer trends. She's been reporting on a particular trend, people going to bed on average earlier and doing nightlife stuff, quote unquote, earlier in the evening. Dinner time reservations getting earlier. Showtimes starting and ending earlier. You could join in at 800-642-1234 if you are participating in this trend or noticing it. Do you miss doing stuff until bar time, 2 in the morning, or are you very glad to be long home by then? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We got a call from Jeff in Wausau who couldn't stay on the line. Jeff says he's noticed bars closing earlier, oftentimes when they're slower later at night than before. Rachel, that reminds me of a restaurant you covered where they said, if we're staying open late to cover 3 tables, is that worth the staff? This is something that not just Jeff's bars are doing. This is something that's out there and with key staffing decisions.
Totally. People who work at restaurants are saying that they are closing their kitchens at 8 p.m. because if there aren't people there to serve, then they are not making any money. So they're opening them earlier and closing them earlier.
And Jeff also wondered if you were familiar with the concept of darties, and I am, because of my kids, daytime parties, where the whole plan is forget the nighttime, the party's going to happen in the daytime in the first place. Do you see that happening? Is this part of the trend you're looking at?
I think that darties have been around for a while. tailgating has always been fun.
Sure.
I don't think that. I'm trying to say nobody's ever had any fun during the daytime before. But rather that a lot of things that we used to do at night are taking place a little bit earlier. I think darties are their own thing.
Now, there used to be peer pressure to stay out late. I certainly experienced it in my 20s, for example. When you talked to younger people, I think you talked to some sorority members, for example, was there that pressure, or was the pressure going in the other direction now?
Yeah, I have been hearing just, like you said, pressure in the other direction. I spoke to a junior at USC who lived in her sorority house when she was a sophomore with 65 other women, and said that she was in bed by 9 p.m. sharp every single night. And instead of people making fun of her for having such an early bedtime, she says that she was bombarded by requests for help moving their own bedtimes earlier. So she had no problem sticking to that bedtime while she was in the sorority, though she did joke that frats have not gotten the message. Those parties are still pretty late.
And social media, you are seeing, I think this is in your reporting, Rachel, on TikTok and elsewhere, there's a lot of advice helping people develop that earlier bedtime sleeping pattern.
Yeah, there's this soft girl trend, which highlights slow-paced indoor activities like journaling, sipping a cup of tea, performing a calming nighttime wind down routine. And those videos have been viewed, at the time of writing this story, a collective 2.9 billion times. So people are really into it.
Rachel Wolf is with us, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. She covers consumer trends there. She's with us for a look at why Americans are going to bed earlier and how it's affecting the way we spend our money and our free time. As we heard, surveys show we're going to bed a little earlier, maybe getting more sleep, especially younger people. And that's leading to earlier, or connected to anyway, earlier dinner reservation times, earlier bar times even. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you find yourself going out to eat earlier than you used to if you go out to eat? Is it harder to get an early dinner reservation if you go to the kind of place that needs reservations? Have earlier start times for movies and live performances made it easier for you to catch a show? If you work in restaurants or hospitality or entertainment of some sort, are those times moving up as you see it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Wolf about why Americans are heading home and going to bed earlier, what it means for restaurant times, curtain times, other staples of nightlife. And we'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Maybe everybody out there is still a late night party person. You never changed this. Or have you noticed yourself calling in a night earlier and earlier over the years? Is that a consequence of getting older? And younger people out there, are you part of this trend where the stuff you do, the fun stuff, is part of the evening life instead of the nightlife? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Rachel, take us into movie theaters. Are we starting to see more matinee options, more matinee seating than those late night shows these days?
They are. Movie theaters are swapping late night screenings for matinees, which is super, super interesting. And so I spoke to the ROC Cinema in Rochester, and they've recently ended late night screenings altogether. The owner estimates the theater does 75% of its business before the 8 p.m. show, which is now the latest offered, and that's up from 45% in 2019. So movie theaters are seeing this shift big time. That 11 p.m. midnight screening is becoming harder to find.
We got an email from Aaron who said he's the audio person at Gibson Community Music Hall in downtown Appleton. They have embraced earlier shows. Typically now they are from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. or maybe 10:30 at the latest. I don't know how late they went before that. When you talked, Rachel, to people who ran, you know, restaurants and movie theaters and things like that, were they happy with this change, or were they like late night people who would rather keep it the old way?
It's definitely a mix. I spoke to one restaurant owner who said that he now, when he gets off work, he used to be able to, you know, he had tons of options for where to go, grab a drink or a bite to eat. He wanted to meet up with people. And now it's so hard to find anywhere. So yeah, the service industry tends to be more of a late night bunch. And so not all of them are happy about it, but it just, it depends. This shift is obviously being driven by, you know, widespread social change. So seems like more of us are into it, but there are definitely people who are late night night owls who are being left behind.
Now, with this this being concentrated, especially among younger people, do you anticipate this being a trend that's here to stay?
Well, I think that'll depend. I can't see the future, but if remote work continues to be popular, if the benefits of sleep continue to be, of getting more sleep continue to be, if we continue to follow that advice, then I think that the shift is probably more permanent than it is a fleeting trend, but only time will tell.
Talking to Rachel Wolf, reporter for the Wall Street Journal, talking about how we're going to bed earlier, according to sleep surveys, and how we're going out and doing stuff earlier, and the late night life may be a thing of the past for a lot of people. Surprised nobody's calling in on this. This seems like something I know some of you are experiencing. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you still like to do stuff way out late at night? Are you defying this trend? Are you happy to see options earlier? Maybe right after work, so you're home by 8 or 9 o'clock and you call it a night there. If you work in restaurants or entertainment or hospitality, Are you seeing this happen where you work? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Rachel, maybe a little too soon to tell, but I mean, is this change affecting the bottom line for some of the businesses in, you know, restaurants and entertainment and some of the other things we've been talking about?
Yeah, that movie theater who I was just talking about, they said, you know, since they are now doing so much of their business before 8 p.m., they're having to introduce more shows earlier to make up for the loss of revenue later on. So, you know, just closing earlier can sometimes mean losing out on that late night business. So they are trying to get creative to compensate. For example, they added a 3 p.m. weekday show where, you know, one would think a lot of people would be working, but the owner said that she's been surprised by its popularity. She said that many customers are young professionals, some of whom she suspects of playing hooky.
Now, do you have a personal preference? If I can ask personally, Rachel, are you happy to see this trend you've been reporting on?
You know, at risk of seeming a little biased, I am selfishly kind of happy that this is becoming more of a norm because, I mean, I live in New Orleans. I love to go out and do things, but I also love that I have more options before. I mean, I'm sometimes in bed by 9, so... Yes, I'm selfishly kind of happy that this is going on, but it's in the proof's in the pudding. The data is showing that I'm not alone.
Let's bring out a caller at 800-642-1234. Peggy is with us in Cedarburg. Peggy, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Peggy?
Well, it's funny. I was always a late night person in terms of watching The Tonight Show or Jimmy Kimmel, at least until 11, and in the last few years, it just doesn't hold it for me anymore. It might be my age, but also the winter comes. It gets so dark so early that by 9 or 9:30, my husband and I think we're ready for bed so we can get up early and take full advantage of the sunlight. We're still energized people. We still are really active, but it's just too much dark, and that is really what has been probably the main reason we are going to bed now by 9 or 9:30.
Wow. Peggy, thanks a lot for sharing that. Now, Rachel, I think a lot of us have felt that way, you know, especially in the winter, or I have, like, oh, it's been dark for 2 hours already. Do I want to go out and do something? On the other hand, we've always had winter that isn't driving a new trend. When you talk to people, did they say they were more prone to want to do stuff earlier in those darker winter months?
Yeah, that came up a little bit, but wasn't the focus of my reporting because, as you said, that's sort of always been a thing. So that first story came out in the early bird story came out in July, actually, which I think was important because that was happening during the summer months when it is lighter for longer. The other story about young people was in the winter. And so surely that's a part of it. But these people are saying that, you know, they had been doing this for a while, not just during the winter months. I do think we're all more inclined to be indoors when it's cold and dark out. That's nothing new, surely. But I, you know, wonder if it has become even more pronounced. I'm not sure.
Peggy, thanks a lot for the call. Rick is with us in Polk County. Rick, hi.
Hi. I guess I'm a little counter to the trend. There's a area in Dresser, Wisconsin, up in Polk County, Trollhagen, and they are open till 3 a.m. on Friday nights in the wintertime.
And do you go out and ski until 3 in the morning, Rick?
I don't, but there's a lot of people who do. Many nights it sells out till, you know, and they're there till 3 in the morning.
Rick, thanks a lot for the call. And Rick makes a good point. It's not like there are no night owls anymore, Rachel. This is the average trend we're talking about here.
Exactly.
Rick, thanks a lot for that. Did you see, when you talked to business people, did you see people try to counter program and try to keep that late night tradition alive? Rachel, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, we lost you for a sec. That's okay.
Sorry about that. I think my service cut out for just a second. I do think that there as with any trend, there's always going to be pushback and a contingent of people who are trying to keep that late night trend alive. So certainly there's still late night fun to be had. I'm not arguing that you're never going to be able to find anything open after midnight ever again. I think that would be sad if so, just that perhaps more people are calling it a night a little bit earlier.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Rachel, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Wonderful. Thanks so much.
That's Rachel Wolf, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, where she covers consumer trends. We've been talking about a recent shift in bedtimes with millennials and Gen Z getting more nightly sleep than previous generations. Everybody heading home for the night sooner, leading to an uptick in things like 5 p.m. dinner reservations and matinee shows. Yeah, back in the day in my band, you know, we'd often play shows till bar time. So I've got memories of loading out of bars at 2:30, 3 in the morning. I don't know if I missed that. The last show I played last month was a matinee. What was it, 1 to 4 p.m., done before sundown. I could make that a more regular part of my life. Still time for you to share your thoughts on the nightlife. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Hey, join WPR Thursday night at 8 for live coverage of the 2024 State of the Union Address. President Joe Biden will deliver the address to a joint meeting of Congress. NPR will bring us live special coverage of that and the Republican Party's response. NPR's own Steve Inskeep, host, members of the NPR politics team, will join the coverage in the studio and from the U.S. Capitol. That special coverage of the 2024 State of the Union Thursday at 8 here on Wisconsin Public Radio or listen online at WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Last month, Governor Evers signed a law allowing Wisconsin high schoolers to gain direct admission into UW-Madison if they are in the top 5% of their graduating classes. The legislation also guarantees admission to all other UW schools for the top 10% of high school students. Coming up, we'll talk to a higher education reporter about how the legislation compares to similar laws in other states, and a counselor at a Wisconsin high school will join us for a look at how it could affect the students he works with. First, the president of the Universities of Wisconsin is with us for a look at the change. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this idea, the top Wisconsin students getting automatic admission? Do you think it'll help keep kids in state for college? Should the state do more to get Wisconsin kids into UW schools? What questions do you have? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jay Rothman has served as the president of the Universities of Wisconsin since 2022. President Rothman, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon, Rob. It's good to be with you.
I gave a quick summary of this change. Can you spell it out a little more for us? How will this new system work?
Well, the way the new system will work is that any student who has finished in the top 5% of their graduating class will have be guaranteed admission under what we're calling the Wisconsin Guarantee. Guaranteed admission into Madison, and any other student who's finished in the top 10% will have guaranteed admission into our other 12 universities within the Universities of Wisconsin. They will have to take some steps. They will have to apply in the normal process to secure that guarantee, but under the Wisconsin Guarantee, they will have automatic access to our universities.
I was looking back at some of the coverage when this was first negotiated as part of some critiques by the state legislature, Republicans in the state legislature of diversity programs. Some of the language suggested that the University of Wisconsin was forced into making this change. Do you view it as a positive or just something you got to do based on that agreement?
Well, it's part of the agreement that we reached with the legislature that unlocked about $800 million of funding for our universities, which was important. But the legislation changed from its original derivation into what was ultimately adopted by the legislature and signed into law by Governor Evers. And we're very comfortable with it. We think this helps keep the best and brightest in Wisconsin. And, you know, with nearly 90% of our in-state graduates from UW system schools remaining in the state 5 years after they graduate, that helps Wisconsin win the war for talent. So we think this is the Wisconsin guarantee is just another avenue, another portal to encourage students to attend our universities, which ultimately benefit the economy and society of the state of Wisconsin.
How do you think this change might affect the makeup of incoming first year classes?
Well, I think it's got the potential of students who, for example, might not have thought they could get into Madison or might not have thought of going to one of our other universities to give it a second look. And I think, you know, certainly the admissions folks at Madison have told me that, you know, the vast, vast majority of the people who have finished in the top 5% of their high school classes in Wisconsin have been admitted to Madison under the holistic admissions approach. But this might encourage a student from Hayward or a student from Milwaukee who might not have otherwise thought they were going to be able to get into Madison to now know that under the Wisconsin guarantee, they will have the opportunity to go to Madison, or if they're in the top 10% to one of our other 12 great universities in the state.
One philosophy of college admissions is, okay, grades, yeah, they're an important part of the application, but there are other things like life experiences, essays, extracurriculars, and the list goes on and on. Does this system put too much of a focus on just the grades?
I don't think so, because it's one element, one way to get into our schools. The traditional application route is still going to be there for students. And we're doing what we're calling Direct Admit Wisconsin, starting this application cycle as well, where students will actually get letters from our universities based on their high school performance, getting them automatically admitted into our universities. So we'll have the traditional first year or the traditional application process. We'll have Direct Admit Wisconsin, and we'll have the Wisconsin guarantee, all as means of encouraging students who want to go on and pursue higher education at one of our universities to make it easier for them to do that.
I had wanted to ask you about the Direct Admit Wisconsin program, so I just want to make sure I have this right. If I'm a high school student, it's been a while, but I'll pretend. If I'm a high school student, I might get a letter from one of the UW campuses without me applying. I might get that letter saying, congratulations, you're in if you want it.
That's exactly right. That's exactly what will happen. And it will allow us then to interact with those students to the extent that they want to pursue that process. We can start talking to them about what they have to go through in terms of financial aid and get them ready for that experience to start college. That is the Direct Admit Wisconsin. And we're excited about that. Again, our goal is to serve the state of Wisconsin, and the more people that we can get in and graduated from our great universities and the universities of Wisconsin, we can help deal with the workforce shortage that Wisconsin is experiencing right now and will continue to experience based on the state's demographics.
Jay Rothman is with us, president of the Universities of Wisconsin, looking at a couple changes in admission policy, including this top 5% guarantee. Top 5% of high school students get into UW-Madison, top 10% into other UW system schools. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Jay, an asterisk here. Some people might be wondering, well, my school doesn't rank students, or my school, I'm a homeschooler. I'm in the top 100% and the bottom 100% of my class. I know there are provisions in the system. What are they?
Yeah, the provisions in the statute that will require high schools to create ranking systems, starting with the class that's currently juniors right now, because the Wisconsin guarantee will apply to the incoming class in the 25-26 school year. So school districts are going to have to do that. For example, the student that is homeschooled will also have the opportunity to seek to gain admission through the Wisconsin guarantee based on ACT scores, and also national merit finalists will be all automatically subject and ineligible for the Wisconsin guarantee. So the Wisconsin guarantee covers public, private schools. It covers school students who are being homeschooled. So that is covering the gamut in terms of ensuring that, again, the best and the brightest in Wisconsin have this opportunity to get admitted to one of our 13 universities.
If somebody's listening across the border in Minnesota thinking, hey, I wanted my kid to get in, use that reciprocity thing, or other out-of-state people might wonder this too, is this new system going to mean fewer spots for out-of-state students?
But it could, because the Wisconsin guarantee only applies to Wisconsin residents. But I think as a practical matter, our focus is to take care of the people of the state of Wisconsin. We are supported by the people. They have built over the many years of investment a great constellation of 13 universities, and we're here to serve the state of Wisconsin, and that's why we are excited about the Wisconsin guarantee.
Let's bring on a caller. Dick is with us in Brooklyn here in Wisconsin. Dick, hi.
Hi. I'm a retired faculty at UW-Madison, and my question is, how many students that would have been in the top 5% would have not been admitted to the university if this program was not in existence?
Dick, it's a really good question. I mean, I have asked that of the admissions staff at Madison, and they have told me that most of the students who are in the top 5%, the vast, vast majority, would have been admitted under the holistic admissions process at Madison in any event. We think, though, that the Wisconsin guarantee will help us get that student who may not have thought they could get into Madison. This will allow them that opportunity and give them assurance that under the Wisconsin guarantee they could. So our expectation is that we will get students that will apply under the Wisconsin guarantee to Madison that who may not have otherwise applied because they didn't think they had a chance of getting in. That, again, will help keep the best and brightest in our state.
Thanks for that call. President Rothman, I know particularly post-COVID, there have been concerns on some campuses about stagnant or even declining enrollment. Do you see these couple of changes we've been talking about, direct admit Wisconsin and then the Wisconsin guarantee, do you see them as part of the solution to that concern?
I really do. This is part of our strategy to try to change what is called the participation rate. That's the number of high school graduates going on to higher education in the state. That has been declining for a number of years now. We have the lowest rate of any state around us. So Minnesota and Iowa and Illinois and Michigan have a higher participation rate. We believe it is essential that we bend that curve, get more of our high school graduates attending our universities. And it's not for the universities. It is for the state of Wisconsin. We are evolving quickly into a knowledge-based, technology-driven, knowledge-based economy. If we don't have those graduates, Wisconsin will suffer economically. And our mission is to serve the state. So as a practical matter, we think bending that participation curve is critical. These are some steps that we have implemented strategically to try to bend that curve upwards so that we are getting the number of students that we should be into our universities so that they in turn can graduate and go out and be employed in the workforce in Wisconsin.
President Rothman, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks very much, Rob. Appreciate your time.
That's Jay Rothman, president of the Universities of Wisconsin, formerly UW System. We talked to him about new legislation guaranteeing admission to UW-Madison for the top 5% of Wisconsin high school students, admission to all other UW campuses for the top 10%. Coming up, we'll talk to a higher education reporter about how this compares to similar laws in other states, and we'll hear from a high school a guidance counselor. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about new legislation that guarantees admission to UW-Madison for the top 5% of Wisconsin graduating classes, guarantees admission to all other UW schools for the top 10%. Laura Spitalniak joins us now, staff reporter for Higher Ed Dive. Laura, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
This is new for Wisconsin. It is not new for states around the country. Can you talk a little bit about what other states have done along these lines?
Absolutely. So guaranteed admissions has gotten an increasing amount of attention following the Supreme Court decision last year regarding race-conscious admissions. Wisconsin, as we heard earlier, is looking to increase enrollment through guaranteed admissions, but just as often I've seen states turning to the process for or as a means of diversifying their student population. One such case is Maryland. Right now, the Maryland General Assembly is weighing a proposed bill that would involve all students in the top 10% of their classes being automatically or I should say guaranteed admissions into the state's publicly funded colleges.
A lot of people have focused on Texas. They've been at this for a little while now. What did they do there and how has it played out?
Texas is an interesting example because they have had probably the most high profile and long running guaranteed acceptance policy. They began in the late 90s. We're there in that case as well. A federal appellate court barred race conscious admissions in three states under its jurisdiction, including Texas. It has remained controversial. It has spurred high profile legal action, including Supreme Court rulings over whether it was inadvertently, or I suppose vertently, offering benefits to some students inappropriately. It remains a prime example for proponents of guaranteed admissions who say it can provide a clear pathway for students. But some research has actually found that the results have been mixed, that it hasn't changed which high schools send students to the state's more selective colleges, and it's still, the details matter. And I think Texas is a really good example of that.
And Texas is comparable to Wisconsin in at least one way. There's one school seen as the, you know, flagship or whatever you want to call it, University of Texas Austin, as UW-Madison is here. What's been, has there been a different impact? Are the, is the cutoff different? How have they treated that?
Yeah, so they, like the new process in Wisconsin, have a higher cutoff for students. You have to be ranked more highly to automatically be guaranteed admission into UT Austin. That school, it remains to be seen if it has actually diversified the population, but like Wisconsin, they said, this is our flagship, this is our, you know, pride and joy. We're going to make it a little more selective for the state's college, prospective college students, excuse me.
And let's spell out the diversification idea. Why would saying we're going to take the top X percent from each high school potentially at least diversify the student body?
In theory, if you're just looking at numbers, if you're just looking at who does the best in each school, you're taking away unconscious bias elements from the application process. It also allows all of the state's high schools to perform at the same level, or compete at the same level, I should say. It means that students who attend very well-resourced high schools aren't going to be inherently better viewed than those who don't. If you're the top, if you're in the top 10% of your high school and your high school only offers one or two AP classes or none at all, that's, you're not automatically being thrown into a pool against students who have incredibly well-resourced high schools and are able to participate in a number of activities that aren't equally accessible.
As you look at what we've got here in Wisconsin, it's a law. It will kick in not till next year. Is there anything that stands out to you as similar or different compared to what other states have tried?
I think it's particularly interesting that this is coming almost in tandem with the University of Wisconsin's direct admissions program. To get deeply semantic, guaranteed admissions programs, you, as it says, are guaranteed admission, but students still have to apply. Direct admissions programs actually involve colleges reaching out to you, that prospective student, without you having to go through the slightly arduous paperwork that's involved with applying for college. So those two things in tandem, I haven't seen an instance, I'm thinking, I haven't seen an instance of that where both are starting at the same time. I think the combination is really going to lead to more students viewing themselves as prospective college material, where for any number of reasons, they haven't thought of themselves through that framework previously. When looking at other states, the more common thing I've seen is that the state systems are the ones dictating what kind of admissions policies they use rather than the state legislature. So that is one way in which Wisconsin is going above and beyond and implementing a broader program. But I think it's going to be a very exciting time to be a student in Wisconsin.
Laura, thanks again for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
That's Laura Spitalniak with Higher Ed Dive, reporter there. We're talking about a new law guaranteeing admission for UW schools for top performing high school students in Wisconsin. Now we'll hear from a counselor at a Wisconsin high school. Troy Arneson is a counselor at Vell Phillips Memorial High School in Madison. Troy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob, for having me on. I appreciate the time.
For students that you work with, especially, I guess we're talking about juniors and younger, is there buzz about this and how it might affect their college application experience?
As Laura and Jay both mentioned, we've got a couple initiatives starting here. This latest one, the Madison Promise, it's fairly new. Not a lot of students are talking about it, but there are some students that are reaching out and wondering how it will impact them and their future choices.
And how, will this affect how you advise your students who are thinking about going to college?
Honestly, I'm not sure it's going to have a great impact on the students at Vell Phillips Memorial. This year, our top 5% is a 4.0. And in my 20 plus years here, I really can't think of a student who's been in that top 5% who hasn't gained admission eventually. Sometimes students get deferred, but they typically end up getting admission. Sometimes those who are deferred, sometimes maybe don't have as strong a transcript with rigor, but they tend to eventually get in if they're in the top 5%.
Now, between the guaranteed admission and then, as you mentioned, that direct admission, do you see this, as Laura was mentioning, do you see this potentially affecting some of those students who might be on the fence or not know if they're college material and maybe giving them a nudge to say, yeah, maybe I can go to a UW system school?
I do. I think it's going to help those students who are really maybe not see themselves as college bound or maybe don't see that in their future. And we've spent some time with our juniors and our younger students this year talking about this initiative and still working out the details. But as counselors, we're really trying to help students find that right fit. So even though they might get a letter from a university this summer, we still want them to, you know, to be informed about their choices and make sure it's a fit academically, make sure it's a fit financially. So it's still going to take a lot of discussion on students and families and school staff to make sure that it's the right place for a student to end up.
I want to flip things around a possible negative here, Troy. A student might look at this and say, well, I'm not in the top 5% of my class, so UW-Madison isn't meant for me. I'm not in the top 10%, so maybe college, period, or at least the UW system isn't right for me. How do you reach out to those students who might still have college potential and talk to them about this?
Yeah, I think President Rothman had some good pieces there when he talked about the holistic approach of the universities. Madison, for instance, has always really, you know, they've had rigor as one of their main reasons for getting in. And so we'll still push rigor and we'll still push that holistic piece. Colleges are looking for more than just a GPA, more than just a number. So we really try to have our students, you know, to figure out what that fit is socially, academically. So it's going to be an interesting few years there until we figure out how this all plays out for our students.
One other possible negative, somebody might say, hey, I'm in the top 6%, forget participating in the musical or the football team or whatever. All my time and energy is going into trying to bump that GPA into the top 5%. Do you worry about that just in our last half a minute or so?
There is the potential of students maybe lessening their rigor just to maintain a 4.0. We're going to have to work with those students and families to figure out what might be the best mode of action. But there are some students who have brought that point up of hey, right now I'm guaranteed. Why risk this by, you know, filling up my senior year with, you know, numerous AP courses?
Troy, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much for your time.
That's Troy Arneson, counselor at Vell Phillips Memorial High School in Madison. We talked to him about a new law that guarantees admission to UW schools for top high school students in Wisconsin and how it could affect the students he advises. We also heard from Universities of Wisconsin President Jay Rothman and Laura Spitalniak, reporter with Higher Ed Dive. If you have thoughts on this, if this is affecting you or maybe your kid or your students, if you work in a school, love to hear about it. You can email us. ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. If you have questions you want us to pursue, either our news team or us here on the talk shows, love to hear those suggestions as well. Email ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, a lot of police departments around the country have relied on technology that detects the sound of gunshots, but there are some serious concerns about the reliability of those systems and whether they're worth the money. Check out the latest news on ShotSpotter technology and some of the objections and concerns it's raised in recent years. Join that conversation. It's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network.
Next Saturday night, we're sending you back to the future.
That's from the movie, wait for it, Back to the Future. It's an example of what film fans call a title drop when a character in the movie says the title of the movie, like Welcome to Jurassic Park, or I Am Iron Man, or Chewie, there's some real Star Wars going on up in here. Okay, that last one didn't happen. It's common, but how common? I just discovered, linked from Metafilter, a website called titledrop.com. They use a data set of over 73,000 movies going back to the 1940s. About a third of those movies had at least one title drop, 36.5% to be exact. Movies named after a character had a large number of drops, with the recent Barbie movie leading the pack, coming in at 267 title drops. On the other hand, about 1 in 10 movies say the name of the movie exactly one time, unlike in radio where I drop the name of the show like 9 times an hour. I could be more dramatic about it. This is Central Time.
You're listening to The Ideas Network from Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll listen back to a conversation with a Wisconsin-based musher and former Iditarod competitor. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about a quirky Wisconsin law.
For years, yellow margarine was illegal in Wisconsin. Why? Well, the history is a little complicated and a little bit strange, but its roots lie in Wisconsin's proud heritage as the dairy state. WPR's Jenny Peek brings us the story.
Wisconsin is America's dairyland. It's a title we take seriously. The state is home to over 1 million cows that produce almost 2.5 billion pounds of milk each month. We even host the World Dairy Expo. For Wisconsin lawmakers, it's an industry worth protecting, and its importance can be traced through a history of sometimes oddball laws. Ed Peel of Columbus, Ohio, reached out to WPR's Wisconsin about one such law. He visited his grandparents in Kenosha as a child, and remembers the margarine being white instead of yellow. His grandfather had told him, it's a Wisconsin law. So Peel asked Wisconsin, is that true? It reminded me of a story I'd heard from my father-in-law, Rob Howell, who grew up in Kenosha. One of his chores as a boy was to mix the yellow dye into the margarine.
Of course, it came in these rectangular 1-pound packages with a little bead of yellow dye. And you had to break that bead and then spread it through the pound of oleo, which is very time consuming. But it was a god-awful mess, you know, because by the time you'd squeeze this oleo for 10 minutes, it had softened way up. Then you had to squirt it out into some sort of container. So it was always pretty unappetizing, but it was super unappetizing when it was white.
Not being able to buy yellow margarine in Wisconsin drove many residents, like the Howells, across state lines to buy the cheaper pre-mixed goods. Border towns like Waukegan, Illinois, boasted pop-up oleo stands advertising their product to traveling Wisconsinites.
Sometimes if we knew ahead of time that we were going to do that, we'd ask our neighbors if they wanted us to pick up a few pounds of colored oleo for them, and we often did, and so often came back with quite a haul of this illegal margarine.
Wisconsin started regulating margarine in 1881. Dave Driscoll, a curator at the Wisconsin Historical Society, says that while the laws have varied, the intent was simple: ensure fair prices for dairy products and prevent fraud.
The most durable objection to margarine was that it's fraudulent in that it's misrepresenting itself as butter. And, you know, it's kind of a pasty white by itself, which in the literature is referred to things like, you know, a corpse-like white, you know. So I think they felt that as long as it didn't look appealing, it didn't look like something delicious for your toast, that, you know, that was good enough.
But people got tired of the regulations and began pushing lawmakers to repeal them.
Throughout the Great Depression and then World War II rationing, more and more people actually had experience of consuming margarine. It was like, well, I've been eating this for years now. You know, it wasn't all that bad and it's significantly cheaper. So I should be able to buy this.
By 1953, only Minnesota and Wisconsin had laws banning yellow margarine. In 1963, Minnesota repealed its ban, leaving Wisconsin as the lone holdout. 4 years later, in 1967, Wisconsin joined the rest of the nation in legalizing yellow margarine. I asked Driscoll why it took so long.
I think in general, it's safe to say that the dairy interests in the state were as strong or stronger here than in most other states.
Even with yellow margarine legal, butter is the go-to spreadable fat in Wisconsin. It's a welcome change for Howell, who still remembers trying butter for the first time when he was seven.
I got one day at Forest Park Elementary School a hot lunch, and I tasted that and was immediately impressed at how much better it was than margarine, which is terrible. And went home with that and was told by my mom that it was butter was too expensive and unhealthy.
But once it was up to him, he steered clear of Oleo.
I haven't eaten margarine, at least knowingly, for probably 50 years.
This story came from an audience question as part of the Why Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future story. Go to wpr.org/whysconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Now, teams of sled dogs and their mushers embarked on the legendary Iditarod race this past weekend in Alaska. Coming up, we'll hear from a Lawrence University grad who was chosen for a special teaching role associated with the races. She was inspired by Wisconsin's own musher, Blair Braverman. Braverman and her husband, Quince Mountain, manage a sled dog team in northern Wisconsin called Braver Mountain Mushing. Here's an excerpt of WPR's Keely Boltina talking to Blair at the end of 2020. You can hear the full interview at WPR.org.
Blair, I hadn't thought of this until you opened your piece with it. When you set out with your sled dogs, they don't know how far they have to run. I mean, it seems so obvious now. What does that mean, though, for your dogs?
It's true. I think that's one of those things, like you said, that you wouldn't think about it, until you're really working with these dogs closely. But, you know, sometimes we go out for a 5-mile run. Sometimes we go out for a 500-mile run. And the dogs don't know. I mean, they have context clues, right? Like if there's a lot of people watching, usually we're in a race, and that means that we're going to go for a longer journey than if we just leave out of the yard at home. But they don't really know, and they don't know, you know, even in a race, we could do 10 miles and then rest, or we could do 60 miles and then rest. And that's the hardest thing. I always think, you know, sometimes I think, oh gosh, if they could speak English for 5 minutes, I could explain so much to them and we would really be on the same page. But of course, that's not the fun of it. The fun of it is figuring out how to communicate despite having very different ways of seeing the world and interacting with it. And the biggest challenge with the dogs not knowing how far they're going to go is that they love running. They want to run, and therefore they don't pace themselves. They run as if they just get to run as hard as they want, and then they get tired. And, you know, but obviously you'd go faster if you're going for 20 miles than if you're going for 100, just like you would with a human. So that's a kind of negotiation we have to do with the dogs where I'm like, okay, trust me, guys, like, you want to take it easy here. And they're like, ugh, you're such a drag.
Now that you've described that situation, what do you see in how we're moving through this pandemic with that context of what you see from the sled?
The main thing when you're taking a team of dogs out for a trip of any length, you know, not one day, but let's say it's going to be a multi-stage race or a multi-stage camping trip where you're camping and sleeping along the way and you're really going on a long journey. You have to front load rest. You have to build in rest that the dogs don't even want because they are ready to keep going. They, you know, maybe you're going to run 30 miles and you as the musher decide, okay, we're going to camp right here. There's a nice river. There's some water. I'm going to build a fire. You know, the dogs think that is so boring because they still have energy. They're not tired yet. They want to keep going. You know, and they don't totally get a choice. Like that's where I come in as the musher is, you know, people always think, how do you get the dogs to run? How do you make the dogs run? And they don't realize that so much of our work as mushers is the total opposite. It's It's really getting the dogs to stop. It's getting the dogs to rest. It's helping them to maintain a pace that's going to be sustainable for them and make it so that the whole trip, however long that is, stays really fun the entire way.
Talk more about front-loading rest, forcing your team to rest, and why you make yourself and the dogs take real breaks even when they don't want to.
You can't really force them to rest. You know, as they say, you can lead a horse to water. But I have some photos from the team I've taken where you set up the best camp, like you put out straw beds, you give them a nice meal, you heat up the meal in your cooker, and it's really like, you know, steaming raw meat, which is disgusting to us, but they love it. And they, you know, you put on their little coats because they sleep in coats and under blankets, and they will just stand and stare at you and be like, we are not taking a nap. This is boring. We like running. You know, so you can't make them sleep, but you can make them wait till at least some of the other dogs have had a chance to sleep.
Blair, there's this moment that you talk about when you discuss the fact that rest builds trust. Will you read that part of your essay for us?
Yeah, absolutely. A sled dog learns that by the time she's hungry, her musher has already prepared a meal. By the time she's tired, she has a warm bed. If she's cold, you have a coat or blanket for her. If she's thirsty, you have water. And it's this security, this trust, that lets her pour herself into the journey, give the trail everything she has without worrying about what comes next. You can't make a sled dog run 100 miles, but if she knows you've got her back, she'll run because she wants to, because she burns to, and she'll bring you along for the ride.
That description just hit me. There's real beauty in feeling like somebody's there for you.
That's why I'm hooked on the sport, honestly. I mean, that's why this is so addictive. People go out for a dog sled ride. You know, I went out for the first time when I was 18 years old, and that was 14 years ago, and which is amazing to me to think it. This has been part of my life for so long. And the dogs are so joyful, and you get to experience with them. You get to experience wilderness with them. You get to experience adventure with them. You get to follow them over the course of their lives as they learn. And then in return, they take you on these amazing journeys. And just the depth of the love is extraordinary.
That's Wisconsin Iditarod racer Blair Braverman talking to Keely Boltina in 2020. Next, we'll hear how Braverman inspired a teacher to bring the Iditarod to her fifth grade classroom. That's next on Central Time. It's Central Time. Lawrence University graduate Kate Neumeyer was selected by organizers of the Iditarod Sled Dog Race to be the 2024 Teacher on the Trail. That includes an invitation to visit Alaska and be part of the race. WPR's Tim Peterson talked to her on Friday.
So we just listened back to a conversation on WPR with Wisconsin's own musher, Blair Braverman. Kate, how did Blair inspire your interest in sled dog racing?
When I heard her interview on NPR, I was really intrigued by her relationship with her dogs. I think that she has a unique way of writing about her dogs with a lot of humor, with a lot of love. And of course, I felt that way about my dog. And so I was just really intrigued with someone who would travel with her dogs alone through the wilderness on such a grueling route. And she just made it sound so fun and so easy. But I also was intrigued because I thought, what if I told my students about this? What if I shared that with them? Would that, you know, boost engagement and inspire them? So that's how I got started.
You decided to actually start incorporating that into your classroom, into your curriculum. Could you give us some examples of what that looks like?
Sure. Every morning when the students walk in, I show a PowerPoint that has like maybe a schedule of what's happening that day. But there's always a photo of some aspect of the Iditarod on that PowerPoint slide. And the students walk in and they start asking questions about it. And that's just a great little teaching point. Another way that I incorporate it is through our character lessons. The very first sled dog book I bought was actually at Denali National Park on a family vacation. And when I read it to my students, I thought, oh my gosh, there are so many great character lessons that fit with our core values. And so I started using sled dog books to teach our core values. And then I thought, you know, we could do more with this. So this past year, I did two new things. When we assign class numbers, instead of just going alphabetical number order down the list, I actually had the students draw bib numbers. And we made little musher bibs, so they're like our name tent. And then that's their class number for the year. So it kind of has this nice connection. And now with the race going on, they can say, well, I'm number 20 and that's so-and-so. And so that kind of helps them get even more connected with the actual mushers. And then one other fun thing that we did is I started doing our class jobs as all Iditarod volunteer positions. So for example, our line leader is the race marshal. We have a vet tech whose job is to keep the first aid kit in our classroom nice and fully stocked. We have an Iditarod Air Force pilot who's responsible for bringing things to the office. So you can see that it isn't just curriculum, you know, articles and in math and so forth, but it's the whole culture of the classroom is around Iditarod.
I love that. And the fact that there's such a different climate between Texas and Alaska, that doesn't create any issues with it resonating with the students?
Oh, no, because as I said, the dogs are a connecting point. Mm. And so when you give students something completely new and fascinating and you talk about it with your own passion, they pick up on that. And so a couple of days before I left for my trip, I brought all of my winter gear to school so the students could see it. And I started with my base layers and I said, okay, what goes next? What goes next? Mm-hmm. And they put all my gear on and they could see the necessity for, you know, being able to have that to survive in the cold.
And we're talking with Kate Neumeyer, an alumna of Lawrence University. And right now she is in Alaska for the start of this year's Iditarod, participating in various activities as the Sled Dog Race's 2024 Teacher on the Trail. Now, Kate, you've been in Alaska for more than a week as Teacher on the Trail. Could you talk a little bit more about what that means?
Yeah. So when I arrived, the first week of my schedule, I was giving school presentations to students around Anchorage, to the north of Anchorage and Wasilla. And, you know, that might seem like an odd thing to do, to give presentations to school kids in Alaska about an iconic Alaska event. Mm-hmm. But what happens is a lot of times students don't know what's in their backyard, or they might know a little bit about it, or they might have some misconceptions. Mm. And so the teachers have invited me to their classrooms to talk to their students about what it is. And, you know, my focus is always the dogs. And so the focus of my presentation was what makes a great sled dog. And so we talked about all the great characteristics that sled dogs have to have and kind of help the students understand what makes these dogs so special. So that was my first week.
And I also understand that you were involved with the junior Iditarod, which has already happened, and that you went to vet checks with the dogs. You worked as a timer. Could you talk a little bit about what you saw and what that experience was like?
Yeah, it was completely amazing. So I was at the start of the junior Iditarod, and so kind of gotten to see the kids, these teenagers, these amazing teenagers, get ready with their dogs and take off down the trail. And then as they were on the trail, I drove with photographer Whitney McLaren to Eagle Quest, which is one of the checkpoints, and I watched them come through the checkpoint. And then we hopped on a snow machine. It was my first time on a snow machine, what we call, you guys call a snowmobile, so they call it a snow machine in Alaska. Mm-hmm. And we headed down the trail. And as we were traveling down that same trail that the kids were traveling down with their dogs, I had a sense of being in their world. I had a sense of having a little bit of a taste of what it's like for them with their dogs on the trail. The environment was quiet, covered in snow, blanketed in this white, you know, ethereal color. I just had a sense of, you know, how profound an experience it is to be on the trail. And when we reached the checkpoint, it was dark and there was almost a full moon. And so, you know, you could hear the dogs. There were tall pine trees. Normally, Yentna Station has a population of 8 people. There's a wonderful family that's been taking care of the lodge there for many, many years. And so we were warmly welcomed. And outside, the kids were at their bonfire, bonding and taking care of their dogs, laughing and enjoying the experience. And it was just magical.
Wow. I mean, this is kind of what you've been dreaming about for years, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, you know, when you get to know about an experience that other, it almost felt like I was invited to join this experience that other people love so much. Because I love it too, and I have a special window into it as a teacher. It was an amazing feeling to feel that I was, you know, really invited to be present in this activity that they love so much.
And now, what's it like to kind of see the adults come in and that transition between how the younger racers approach it and now this excitement with the adults coming in?
So the junior mushers are age 14 through 17, the ages of my own kids. And so I was kind of enjoying their teenage enthusiasm, but also observing their incredible maturity, their love for their dogs, the care. So that's obviously one thing that the teens and the adults have in common, is that they love the sport and they, most of all, they love their dogs. The adults are much more experienced, many of them. And so they approach it differently, but I think also with the same air of excitement, because they also get to enjoy 10 or more days on the trail with their very, very best friends, their dogs.
What's something that you maybe weren't expecting to experience that maybe surprised you that you are planning to take back to your classroom in Texas?
I think that my students' experience with professional athletes are all about how, you know, NFL or NBA stars are kind of these superstar people. And a lot of people do kind of look at mushers this way. But when I was in the room with them, meeting them, they're people just like us. They're people with a passion for a way of life and, of course, dogs, particularly Alaskan Husky sled dogs. And, you know, it's easy to talk with them, especially because, you know, I'm a teacher. I want to know what they think and and how they approach the race and just anything they want to share. So just talking with them as a normal person, and I don't think it really surprised me, but it was just such a wonderful thing to get to experience.
I love that. And what are you most looking forward to on the rest of your adventure while you're in Alaska?
Well, I look forward to getting out on the trail and, again, kind of getting into this intimate world of racers, dogs, but also volunteers, pilots, anyone who is on the trail and feels the same passion for the race. Maybe they're not actually racing, but they've been working comms at a certain checkpoint for many, many years. And so there's this whole culture around it that I think is really important, maybe that we're losing a little bit with our modern world full of devices, that you're all invested in something together and you're working as a team with total strangers. And so that's what's exciting to me. I'm also a little bit nervous about the cold and kind of the grit. And I'm thinking, these mushers can do it. If I emulate what they do, you know, wear my layers, I can kind of, you know, grow personally along with them. So,
well, we know that you're going to stay warm. Thank you so much for sharing your time and your experience with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
That was Lawrence University graduate Kate Neumeier in Alaska talking to WPR's Tim Peterson. She's the 2024 Iditarod Teacher on the Trail. Talk to her about how she's bringing themes and passion from the sled dog race into her own classroom and classrooms around the country.